Good afternoon and welcome to Sundays with the Modern. My name is Erin Starr White and I'm Assistant Curator of Education for Docent Programs here at the Modern. This afternoon, we are privileged to have Dr. Kenneth Eastman here to share his thoughts on the exhibition Kehinde Wiley, A New Republic. As an educator, can I call you Ken?
Please.
Okay. As an educator, Ken worked for 31 years as a librarian at the Atlanta Fulton Public Library in Atlanta, specifically as a film librarian and media manager. He completed his PhD in film history and theory in 2001 at Emory University. After retiring from the library, he taught courses in African American cinema and the African diaspora at the Oxford College campus of Emory. Ken was one of the founders of the Atlanta African Film Society and curated films for the National Black Arts Festival and the 1996 Cultural Olympiad, a part of the 1996 Atlanta Olympic Games. He served on the board of American Film Institute's Educational Outreach and on the selection committee of the PBS series POV, or Point of View. Additionally, Ken was a juror for FESPACO, the Pan American Film Festival.
Pan African.
Thank you. That's a difference.
Right.
The Pan African Film Festival held in Burkina Faso in West Africa. I think that you will find Ken's perspective on the exhibition adding depth and nuance to your own understanding of Wiley's work. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kenneth Eastman.
Thank you. Don't embarrass me, now stop. I was telling someone just a moment ago that I had seen Kehinde Wiley's work, you know, in coffee table books and this kind of thing. And about 2 years ago, a friend of mine was visiting from New York, and he wanted to come to the Modern, so we came over here, and we started up these steps, this grand staircase, and the picture, the painting behind you there, was hanging at this spot, and we both just froze. It was the most extraordinary experience. I mean, it was almost like a religious epiphany. I was just so taken with his work that from then on, I sort of made it a hobby to learn as much about him as I could. Who is Kehinde Wiley? Well, he was born in 1977. He is a self-identified gay man. He is an extraordinary artist. He was reared by his mother because I believe his father had returned to Africa. His father is from Nigeria, from the Yoruba people. And all of this informs his work. And when he was 12 years old, his talents were already starting to be recognized, and he went to Russia to an art camp, which is just absolutely wonderful, wonderful. Also, he speaks Mandarin. How cool is that? Anyway, at the age of 20, he made his first sojourn to Africa because he wanted to meet his father and get in touch with the African part of him. And I can identify with that experience because I remember my first trip to Africa, and it was in the 1980s coming off of the Ungawa Black Power, and we got over there, and I came down the steps of the plane, and I'm saying, oh, thank you, Jesus, I'm home. And I walked down the steps, and it didn't even smell right. It was such an extraordinary experience for me. And that is when I came to the conclusion that I am a hybrid. We African Americans are something that has never existed before. And it is a perilous mistake to go to Africa thinking that you're going home. And I found that out the hard way because my students would frequently ask me, what did you think of Africa? And I said, it's foreign. And I was shocked by that, and I was shocked to have to admit it. But As I say, all of these identities informed Wiley's work. And he is part of an arc of black gay intellectuals, artists, and writers who have had such a prominent part in the movement for liberation, including Baird Rustin, who organized the March on Washington but was not allowed to speak because of the homophobia that was around him. There's Audre Lorde, Alice Walker, and you just go on and on. And there is a postmodernist, performance art group called Pomo Afro Homo, who were absolutely extraordinary. And they were turned down for several festivals because people were not prepared to deal with them. Well, we are hopefully in a more enlightened moment now. And I bring this up because you have to understand this to understand his work. That there is this whole movement of queer art that has informed our experience in this country. In fact, Emory University will be starting it soon, but Brown University has a course called Black Lavender. Don't you love that? The African American gay experience. And I thought I was just so excited when I saw that Emory was going to do it too. Well, anyway, shall we move on? This painting here just absolutely blows me away. It was one of his rare commissions. Apparently, he does not do a lot of commissions. And I love the story when he was here speaking. He talked about Michael Jackson calling him about the commission. And he said, yeah, sure, right, and hung up. And it was like on the third call before he finally recognized that it was, yep, the real Michael Jackson. And so apparently they had a very mutually enriching discussion as they talked about this piece of this commission. One of the things I feel about this piece, and this is in hindsight, Michael never saw this painting. He died before it was completed. And the two cherubs up there just remind me of the apotheosis, that like he's being lifted up into rock star heaven. And that is something that is used frequently in 17th and 18th century art, the apotheosis of the great man and the denizens of the great beyond lift him up. And in hindsight, I mean, there's almost a prescience there that is a little bit scary, especially in view of the fact that he never saw the painting. And I love it. And I believe that this painting is owned by a museum in Berlin. And I'm glad it was able to travel here for this show. By the way, I have had friends who have come down from Atlanta to see this show because it is not traveling there. I mean, in spite of all of Atlanta's pretensions of being, you know, the capital of Black America, sometime it does drop the ball. This is another favorite painting of mine, and the mugshot study. It was 60 years ago last week that Rosa Parks was arrested for not standing up for freedom, but refusing to stand up. And her mugshot number was 7056. We have a hint of this young man's number here. What disturbs me greatly about this piece, I mean, the piece is beautiful. He found a piece of paper on the street that had all of the, it was a police report. And one of the ironic things in it is that it, at the bottom it's printed in very large letters, for police use only. And it was rolling down the street, just free as you could be. And he looked at the statistics, that was the young man's age, his crime, so on and so forth. And he felt like that that was like a verbal portrait of this young man. And he decided to make to take this mugshot and raise it to the level of, quotation marks, high art. And he does a magnificent job of it. It is a beautiful piece, but there is always that hint of the number, and that is 998-2697, and I hope that is not in a continuous arc with Rosa Parks' number, because if it is, we're in deep trouble. We have his sculpture pieces here, which I like very much. I need to stop saying that. I love everything he does. This piece right here reminds me very much of Ulon, the sculptor at Versailles, and he did lots of kings and queens and princes. And this young man is sculptured so beautifully with the same sort of throwaway arrogance that the French upper classes live their lives by. And I love the juxtaposition of him in a hoodie giving you attitude. Lovely, just lovely. This piece here, what can I say? Young African man, Nike shoe on his head, one of America's great contributions to 20th century civilization, Michael Jackson and the Nike shoe. And this is an important image because these shoes are frequently marketed in Africa, where the shoes can cost $300-$400, and people are living on $300 a year. I mean, this is an aspirational acquisition, and yet it is on his head. I mean, there is something going on here that is not healthy, and he's commenting on it, and commenting on it beautifully. Africa has a very long history of metal casting. Many of you may be familiar with the Benin bronzes that are absolutely so gorgeous. However, these were not cast on the continent, but they are still magnificent. And the thing of it is that as a sculptor working in bronze, you have to find the right person to cast your work, because they can destroy the most magnificent idea. And he has found this way to find the very best people. You'll see it in a minute here when we start looking at the stained glass, that it was put together from him in Eastern Europe, because he went to find the best stained glass workers on the planet to do it. And this one, gotta love it. Negro as Napoleon. Magnificent piece. And one of the things that you will note on much of his art is that his frames are not an afterthought. They are an integral part of a whole. And there is a sensuality going on in here, like the taut muscles of the horse. And then in the frame, there are sperm on the at the corners here. And this face peeking out at you from that vaginal-like opening is one of his few self-portraits. He doesn't include himself in his art very much, but that was a self-portrait of him. And I remember I was here one time and somebody was asking about the carvings there on the stone. Those are people who successfully crossed the Alps, and along with Napoleon. Well, Bonaparte is there. This piece here is owned by our museum. Yes, I'm taking ownership now. Our museum. And this is the one that I said that just brought me up to a screeching halt when walking up the staircase and saw it. His backgrounds are just so rich. They're Rococo, they're Baroque, and they cannot be contained. I mean, they leap out. They they engulf the subject. He doesn't allow you the comfort of this is background, this is foreground, this is subject. It is all melded together as the background just leaps out at you and subsumes the subject. Can't tell how I like him. Now, this is from a series of paintings that he did called Down. And he did a series of paintings of young black men in recumbent positions. And again, that almost prescience about it, because with the news headlines today, to see a young black man in a supine position raises lots and lots of issues. But this is not what he was doing. What he was doing with that wonderful William Morris background, don't you just love that? And again, it can't be contained. This person, young man, is vulnerable and incredibly sensuous. And he does that frequently with his work, and his people look at you. Now, there is a history in this country of, well, at one point it was stepping off the sidewalk, but you did not look the master in the face. You did not look white people in the face. And his people have the unmitigated gall to stare at you unflinchingly and dare you to say something about it. And we respond to it in a visceral manner. Because so many of his subjects are young black men, they frighten us. There is this thing, you know, I mean, I've heard people say, both people of all racial persuasions, shall we call it, who have been frightened by a group of four young black men walking down the street. You know, people will turn and go the other way. And that's what one of the things that make this so incredible is because this young man is so vulnerable. And he's also wearing Fruit of the Loom, which brings up another issue, which is very personal for me, because how we engender class and wealth shows up in the strangest ways. The good folk up on the hill wore Hanes. My mama's sharp as Sears. So we got Fruit of the Loom. And there was the class differential going on right there in something as innocuous as your drawers. Let's walk in here into the stained glass room where there are these magnificent pieces. Now, you have probably noticed the absolute luminosity that he gets in the skin. And you do these in glass and light them from behind. And it radiates. Just absolutely incredible. And as a person with a film background, I am very aware that it has only probably has been in the last, oh my gosh, 20, 25 years that television and movies have known how to light black skin for the camera. Max Factor did not make makeup for us. And so all of that had to be restudied. And his stained glass, we are looking at the glory of black skin. I mean, it's transcendent. And there ain't much else I can say about this except they're just fabulous. And I love them. Well, it's stained glass.
I know, but you said something else.
Oh, I don't know. Once I get going.
How he defines, each.
Well, this is not of a particular era, only insofar as that most of us are conversant with stained glass in churches. Mm-hmm. And he uses the Gothic arch to put his people in. And in a way, these young men become saints now. That they've been transformed. They've become something magnificent and other. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but yes.
You just made me think of something I hadn't thought of.
Uh-oh.
In the Catholic tradition, to be a saint, you have to be persecuted and martyred. And I never thought about that with these young men.
Again, with the headlines today, I mean, that takes on new significance and new meaning. And, but one of the reasons I'm sort of waltzing around that, I don't want these men to become professional victims, and I'm not going to contribute to that. I'm trying to avoid that. It would be so easy for them to collapse under their own victimization. And there's a heck of a lot more to these young men than that. These are beautiful. And they are, walk up when you get a chance and look at them closely. Because there is, photorealism doesn't even sound like the right word. I mean, because, and the detail, I mean, he's working with brushes with one strand of mink hair in it, practically. You know, I mean, to get that kind of detail in this size of a picture. And these are very precious because that really is gold leaf. And these are as if these young men were icons, which rolls over into the religiosity that we saw in the stained glass there. And we are seeing black men as neither strange fruit or mandingo. There's a wide range of our experience, and they can be saints and sinners too. And the young man here with the tattoos, that is, oh. That, I mean, when I look at that, and I know a number of people of his generation, including some of my students, who are having pictures tattooed of their children. And that, I find that just so incredible. And when I was coming along, black folk didn't get tattoos. This is a relatively new way of expressing, it grows out of the hip-hop generation. Because nice folk didn't get tattoos. That's what my mama said. And when my mother spoke, you listened. Yes, uh-huh. Aaron, what significance do you lend to his vegetable background, shall we call it? I mean, they are very floral.
Yes.
And they're very rich. I mean, that is so rich. I mean, you think about.
Yeah.
By incidentally, I'll tell you about how that is painted in just a moment.
Yeah. So if we look at this one, for example, the background is always this vegetal, organic. Mm-hmm. Relating to Mother Nature. And so Wiley talks about it as Mother Nature enveloping these figures and taking care of them, you know. There's also the idea of someone who traditionally has been in the background of history, kind of changing things up and making you question what's in the foreground, what's in the background, why. And I'm sure there's more interpretations, but those are the two that he talks about.
I saw something where somebody had taken exception with a floral background in wrapping up the young man, that it was like almost like the wildness of nature was reclaiming them. And the tiny hairs on the back of my neck stood up, because how dare you speak of wildness when you talk with people of Africa? I mean, that's a tad bit presumptuous. But people, you know, they're entitled to their own reviews. We don't read reviews, people. We don't read reviews. This, right around the corner here, is another one of my favorites, because these two young men here, and I have never quite, well, he calls it Dogon couple because it's based on a piece of Dogon sculpture, though neither of the young men are from Mali, which is where the Dogon people live. One of the young men is Nigerian, and the other one is Senegalese. And in fact, the young man from Senegal is actually wearing the Senegal national colors of their soccer team. And the medallion around his neck is President Senghor, who was Senegal's first president after independence, and one of the great soaring intellects of African thought. I know it sounds simplistic now, but he was the one, and I cannot begin to quote all of his reasoning. I mean, I ain't got that kind of brain power. He was the one who came up with the idea of African solutions for African problems. It seems so obvious, but in 1962, nobody had ever thought of that. No one. And so I see in this young man a level of sophistication that goes beyond his modest appearance. Because usually these medallions are made of leather, and they will either have cowrie shells or a girlfriend or some kind of small message inside of them, something that is important to the individuals that's wearing it. And this just is incredible to me that a young man of that generation, God, I'm being ageist now, aren't I, would even know President Senghor. Because he was one of the, after independence, he was one of the first presidents of an African country to step down. Most of them, you had to wait for them to die, or there was a revolution and blood was on the ground. I mean, why doesn't Africa work? Well, you steal 14 million people and you colonize what's left. How do you expect it to work? These are pieces that were shown in the Jewish Museum in Manhattan. And I did not see these pieces there, but the Jewish Museum is the old Warburg Mansion, which is one of those grand Gilded Age mansions. And from what I understand, these pictures worked so well in there. They look like they were painted specifically for that gallery. This one here is, by the way, the statement across the top, this is a very poor translation, and anybody who reads Hebrew, please forgive me. But it basically says, why can't we all get along? And one of these young men, one is Jewish, and the other one is Muslim. And he doesn't distinguish between them, but there is a tension there, even though they are shaking hands. But then they turn to stare out at us. This puts the onus is on us now to work out what is actually being said and being done here. I mean, are they truly friends? I don't know. Or is that even a valid question? Does it even really have any meaning? Because they're both Israelis. And love him. Talk about attitude. This young man is Falasha. And that's the Ethiopian Jews. And in the early to mid-90s, thousands of Falasha left Ethiopia because they were always a persecuted people. Ethiopia was one of the earliest Christian countries in the world. So, and they persecuted the Jews who traced their background back to the Manelik the First, who is in Ethiopian history, is the son of King David and the Queen of Sheba. And so these people have a very ancient heritage in Ethiopia, and have, in spite of being isolated from European Jewry or even Asian Jewry, they maintained many of the rituals and dietetic codes and adhered to them so closely that there was no question about their Jewishness when it came time for them to immigrate to Israel, which is the homeland of all the Jews. It has not been a smooth transition. And it's my understanding that many of the Falasha who immigrated to Israel have left because of racism and have now gone to Europe. And here are my ladies. I was over here last week and I told the guard here that I want that for my living room. I would have to rebuild my house. But that is cast as a single piece. The only moving parts of that are the earrings. And what would you give for those cheekbones? That is just lovely. I mean, that is African beauty at its finest. And then there's all the issues of hair, which is another lecture for another time. Because I also do a bad hair lecture. And because I don't think there's any such thing as bad hair or good hair. As long as it serves its function, it's good. It's all good. My sister commented on the fact that all of these women have these wide leather belts around their waist, which are sort of reminiscent of the protection that might have been worn by a gladiator in ancient Rome. And I thought about that, and I said, whoa, what an interesting idea. I said, these sisters are girding for battle. And by the way, the gowns that they are wearing are Givenchy. This is one of the times that he does not use, allows his subjects to choose their own clothes. This is all haute couture. And Judith has worked a number on Holofernes here. I love it. I love it. And I love her attitude. Isn't that just extraordinary? One of the things that I am not quite clear on is that it is obvious that that these women have hair pieces on. And yet it could have been painted out where it would not have been visible. But he made a point of leaving it there, where the pompadours put on, where the extensions are. And I'm not sure what he was saying with that or what he was doing with that, but I always found that interesting. And especially, pardon me, I should have mapped this out. And this is the glory of the dew. That hair is absolutely wonderful, wonderful. And it is based on a painting of one of the relatives of Prince Albert, and which was an extraordinary thing to do at that time, to paint her with her back out. I mean, the aristocracy usually wanted you to know who they were. But this, and I think this is so triumphant, the way that she turns her back on us, too. And again, the foliage is encroaching. Like I say, I'm not quite sure what that means, but I love it. Love it.
I have just a thought.
Uh-huh.
In the original one in Brooklyn,
oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, well, Queen Victoria had a lot of oddities. I mean, right. And the fact that she had the hands and feet of each of her newborn children carved into marble.
I mean,
and you can still see them because they're at, is it Osborne? Their summer palace? Anyway, they had so many. They're still on her desk. All these little tiny hands and feet. That were commissioned by the leading artists of their day to be carved. Now, this is the international spirit of Kehinde Wiley. These subjects here are Haitian. And he has opened an atelier in Haiti. He's opened one in China. He has opened one in Africa, in Senegal. And I love that idea, the classic studio style of making art. And it is like an apprenticeship, because I was going to tell you how the backgrounds were done. Well, one of the things about it is that he paints the main subject, and then his apprentices do the grunt work on the background. But what a training that is. I mean, to get that kind of detail over and over and over again, you learn. Now, here's my girl here. love her. Talk about attitude. And these young women were allowed to wear their favorite outfits. And she's looking good. And she doesn't care if you agree or not. Because this is about me. And now this one over here is entitled John the Baptist in the Wilderness. And that's another of things that Wiley does frequently. He will twist genders because a lot of the pictures in the stained glass room, a lot of those saints were women. And he put young men in their places. One of the things I love about this is the color. Those pinks and greens just leap out at you. And her dress is just stunning. But he has an eye for color that is just humbling. And he has an encyclopedic knowledge of art. Because before you take one of these pieces that are so well known and play games with it, you have to know why it was there to begin with. It was like somebody said, talking about Picasso. Picasso was a highly well-trained traditional artist. I mean, he could draw beautifully. He knew the rules before he broke them. And same thing with Stravinsky. A lot of people, the edge you work, I mean, you are reacting and responding to something that you have a clear understanding of. And so it is not quite as easy as it may seem. And don't ever say, I could have done that. Actually, it's highly unlikely you could have. Oh, and where's the chapel? Ah, another favorite space. Again, precious, precious small works with incredible, incredible detail. And these have always reminded me of the kind of small portable altar that a high church prelate may have carried on the road with him. And it is done in materials equally fine. More gold leaf, that extraordinary execution of detail in the paintings themselves. And this is a meditative space. And I love the way this show is mounted. Love the way these three pieces are mounted. I mean, it's almost like a prayer deal right there in front of them. You could almost sit there for a little while. But again, this is raising that the image of the black male to sainthood. I mean, seeing black men is almost a religious experience in his eye. Now, that does not say there aren't bad boys out there, and there are people you probably would want to avoid. But this just gives us another way of seeing black males, and it expands the universe they exist in. It isn't all about hip-hop, saggy jeans, although a lot of it is, which I don't get. I don't get hip-hop. And if somebody can take the time to explain it to me, please do one day. Because I have heard hip-hop all around the world. I heard it in Wolof in Senegal. I heard it in Bantu in South Africa. I've heard it in French. And it's as offensive in Wolof as it is in English. But again, that could be a generational difference. Because there's 30 years of difference between me and Kehinde Wiley. So, I mean, you know, he grew up in a different universe than the one that I came up in. Thank goodness. I would hate to still be fighting those battles. Now, this goes to his China period, which is where a lot of the backgrounds of these paintings are done at a studio that he has in Shanghai. And apparently people are flocking to his studio to work for him because, I mean, the rigorousness that is required to paint those kind of backgrounds is a very fine way to learn. Now, these are based on classic Chinese paintings. During the Maoist period, there were not enough doctors for all of the people. And so they came up with this idea of barefoot doctors. And the original of this is a young woman heading to the mountains to bring health care to people. See there? That's what I told you. Anyway, and so he has done that gender switch thing again. And here is a young black man as a barefoot doctor in Asia. I love it. And again, there's still the vegetation in the background, but it has a more Asian feel to it now. It looks like a lot of the things that we have seen in Asian paintings, a lot of things I've seen. Let's see. There was another piece. Ah, it's down here. I had the dubious distinction of seeing a production of a Chinese opera entitled Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. That was the longest 2.5 hours I have ever spent in my life. It was absolutely extraordinary. And, pardon me. And this is, this would have come, this would have, the original of this was done about the same time. Except it is two sisters who are the pride of their nation. And I am glad he decided not to do Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. But this is an extraordinary piece. And again, it places black males in a totally new milieu. And it's legitimate. It isn't forced. He's not straining to do this. And this is a smile. Oh, this is back to the. Where's the smile?
Next one, we're down.
All right, thank you. Ah, yes. These are not still photographs. These young men were brought in his studio and told to stand there and hold a smile as long as you can.
That scared me when they started moving.
I know. And look at the strain. And I think he was commenting on the anger that a lot of young black Americans feel, and how we are sometimes forced to smile through things as a survival strategy. But we've always done it. The first minstrels were black people. Only later on did whites start to put charcoal on their faces, so we were skinning and grinning. I love that phrase. Long before these young men, bless his heart, he is trying so hard. And it just goes on like that. And this is another one of those pieces that perhaps we should sit and contemplate and work through. I mean, the brother over here, he looks like he is on the verge of losing it. This probably was a nice young man who would not harm you. But you sit there and you grin like that for half an hour, and you're probably in danger. I hope that I have shared some of my ideas about it, about the work of Kehinde Wiley, because I feel like it is, I did not want to do a didactic lecture, which it almost turned into. I wanted us to have a dialogue because we each bring our own background, our own experiences to how we respond and react to his work. There is no legitimate response. There are no right answers. But we are in the presence of greatness. This is an artist that we will be hearing about for a very long time to come because he has just started. And he works in so many different mediums, stained glass. There are no marble busts of his out here, but he also carves in marble. He is a photographer. He designed fabrics, textiles. And I didn't know that because if you've ever seen him, he wears the most extraordinary suits. And frequently, the textiles that these suits are made from are his own design. And so the brother is off the chain. Would that I had that kind of talent. I mean, I'm humbled to even just stand here and try to understand everything that's going on in this magnificent brain. So this, by the way, this is the fifth time I've walked through the show. Now, I don't go through the whole show. I just go and commiserate with my favorites. I just, hey, girls. And we hang out for a little while together. But I am still learning and still picking up more. And I'm seeing things today that I hadn't seen before. I have not had enough time to interpret it yet, so I'm going to keep it to myself until I figure out, now, why am I moved by that? I want to thank you all for your attention and for my erratic behavior because I am so nervous. I am used to lecturing before a group of students. I am not used to lecturing before my peers. And I am sure that there are many of you here who have far greater knowledge, at least I hope so, about art than I do. Because I look at myself, I am a consumer. I like art. And when I can, I buy art. Unfortunately, I do not make art. And with that, I'll say thank you very much.